Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here with us today. Sunday morning wake-up call. Following the comedy show with conversations about terminal illness, grief, and death with Hospice of the Piedmont and Rachel Palm. Good morning, Rachel. How are you today?
Hi, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
And thank you so much for being here. We're this Sunday at 11 o'clock.
Happy
the perfect
to be here.
Time
yes.
to have this kind of conversation, isn't
Why
it?
Why not? Yeah. Anytime is the perfect time.
Well, and you know what? We're going to get into that throughout the hour, aren't we? About how maybe not any time is the perfect time, but any time and at some time you have to have the conversation before it's too late and difficult to have the conversation. Isn't that true?
Amen. Yes.
Amen. We're going to be saying that a lot this hour, too, aren't we?
I guess so.
So Rachel is with Hospice of the Piedmont. You can find them at HOPVA.org, Hospice of Piedmont, Virginia.org, HOPVA.org. Write that down, because I think at some point during the hour, you're going to say, you know what, I need to go look into that a little more. So Rachel Palm with us today from Hospice of the Piedmont here. We are going to be talking about terminal illness, hospice care, grief, and death. I've been getting a little sort of grief tilted toward me myself this Have week you? for such a difficult, you know, why are you talking about that on Sunday? You know, as Clinton and was leaving the room, he's saying, yeah, we got everybody all worked up with that jokey, you know, humorous conversation. And now you can talk about hospice care and some others. You know, my wife in the car driving up from a trip she's taking this weekend saying, yeah, I'll listen to you talk about that that wonderful topic. You go to work every day to talk about these things in this environment. Explain that to me. How do you do this? Because I would think that that what people are referring to, the sadness of the conversation, that can't be the complete ring that you work in.
Yeah, very true. So there's a lot of sadness. There are days when you're dealing with death that you cry and I cry. But really the thing that I want to share with listeners is that we're trying to create a positive experience at the end of life. And I became involved in this work because when my father passed away in hospice care, the workers, the nurses, the chaplains, the social workers that came into my home and cared for him at the end of his life helped make what could have been a really difficult crisis situation easier. It wasn't easy by any means, but having hospice care for my dad and then having grief support care for myself and my family afterwards, it really helped to transform that experience. And I look back on that and it's not as sad as it could have been had we not had that help. So when I go to work every day, first of all, I'm not doing direct patient care, so I just want to put that out there ahead of time. I'm working at a computer in an office. I'm not dealing with our many patients across Central and Northern Virginia, so I'm not with the patients that are actively dying. So I, first of all, have that distance, which helps every day not be quite so sad. So our nurses and our chaplains and social workers and volunteers are the ones who are going out and providing direct patient care to our terminally ill patients. But when I go to work, I really think about sharing the message of what we're doing, which is attempting to positively transform the death and serious illness and dying process. So that's what I focus on every day. And I get to do that in ways that are creative. And for me, I really enjoy it. I really enjoy working for an organization where I feel as if I'm making a difference. I'm contributing something greater, helping families in some really small way every day when I go to work. So it's not all sad. I truly love what I do. I have a really great job, and I talk about all the time. I really got lucky to find this job that fit my preferences and my abilities so well.
This is 94.7 WPVC, Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. Sunday morning wake-up call. I'm Rick Moore. We're talking with Rachel Palm from Hospice of the Piedmont. And we're going to be talking about terminal illness as well as hospice care in general. Rachel, you talked about your job being creative.
Yeah.
I'd like you to define hospice care.
Sure.
And then tell me where creativity falls into that.
Okay. Well, so hospice care is a method of care. It's an interdisciplinary method of care that is whole body care. So we care for a patient providing comfort care. So when a patient no longer wants to pursue curative treatment, if their physician says, okay, we think if this disease, this terminal illness, runs its normal course, you probably have 6 months or less to live. And that patient decides, okay, I don't want to have chemotherapy. I don't want to have radiation. I don't want to continue to pursue these curative methods for whatever reason. And they want to have comfort care. They want to really invest in the quality of life, spend time with family, be wherever they call home, whether that's at home, at a nursing home, an assisted living facility, a retirement home, then we come in and provide care for them that nurtures their spirituality, their emotional component, their physical well-being, and also their social well-being. So we really care for the whole patient, not just medical care is typically just caring for the physical being, for the body, you know, curing the body and healing the body. We provide whole body care. So that's what hospice is.
So tell me where the creativity falls into that.
So my job in particular is marketing and communications. So what I'm trying to do is spread the word across our 12-county service region that covers Central and Northern Virginia about all of the neat things that we're doing. We have wonderful programs that support the community, the family, and the patient. And we also do a number of really neat fundraising events that I'm part of. So my work in marketing is to promote these events, to share communications about these events. I also have the really cool job of telling patient stories through our various marketing materials. So these are really powerful stories. Our patients come to us in really desperate, vulnerable situations. And a lot of times when they come to us, we're able to provide them with great relief. We're able to provide them with comfort. We're able to help them say the things that they need to say at the end of their life to their family and their friends. We're able to help them fulfill final wishes. And part of my job is to tell those stories. So I go and meet with patients or meet with families and hear those stories and then share them with our community, which in turn provides support for our organization, which allows us to continue to provide the care that we provide.
Are you going to be able to tell us some stories throughout the hour?
Yeah, certainly. I've got so many. I don't know where to start. I mean,
all right. Well, think about it.
Yeah.
We'll come back to you. And, you know, I'll ask you for a story a little bit. So
okay.
let the back of the mind percolate on some of the stories.
Okay.
And we'll ask for those in a little bit. Again, Rachel Palm here from Hospice of the Piedmont. You mentioned fundraising.
Yes.
Why, Hospice of the Piedmont, I would think that with all the money that is part of the medical trade, why in the world would a financially sound business, I'm sure that you make millions of dollars, why do you need to fundraise for anything?
That's really, actually, it's a great question. So I'll tackle this a couple of different, it's kind of a multi-tiered answer. So the services that we provide under the hospice benefit are reimbursable through private insurance, Medicare, and Medicaid. They're reimbursable at a certain rate every day, depending on the care that we provide. So when we have, let's say, 200 patients, we're getting 200 reimbursements every day from Medicare or Medicaid or private insurance for the care that we provide. But that really goes to provide that care. So that's direct patient care. we provide all of these other services outside of that core hospice care, the service at the bedside for the patient and family. We have programs that, as you mentioned, we have grief support programs. We have inpatient units that just, they're a little bit different from how they're reimbursed. So we get different reimbursement levels depending on the care that we provide. There is a gap between the care that we provide and the services, the care that we are reimbursed for and the services that we provide. So this is one of the reasons that we are really different, because we are a nonprofit. Let's say I'm going to compare us to another hospice who is for-profit. That for-profit hospice is only going to provide the care that they're reimbursed for, right? So that they can have money in and money out, and they can benefit financially.
They can get their 15% off the top, or...
Exactly. And that's what's driving their services. They're providing their services based on their financial gain. As a nonprofit, we're providing services based on what the community tells us they need. So the community says, we need a grief support program in schools for tragedies that happen. If a child were to pass away in a school, they want some certified therapist to come in and work with the other kids that are in that school to provide them with grief support after that event. That's the sort of thing that Hospice of the Piedmont does that we don't get reimbursement for. We don't go back to the insurance company or Medicare or Medicaid. We never bill anyone at the school. Those services are provided free of charge. However, we still have those people on staff that are providing those services. We have to pay those people. We have overhead. We have the costs that go along with that program. So there's that gap there with all of the services that we provide above and beyond the core hospice services that we are reimbursed for. And that's where fundraising comes in. So fundraising helps us to close that gap and really be able to provide this comprehensive breadth of services above and beyond the core hospice services.
12 minutes after the hour with Rachel Palm from Hospice of the Piedmont. We are talking about hospice care and terminal illness. Rachel, when you were given the definition, you mentioned the final 6 months of life. Mm-hmm. How do you make that determination? Is there, we don't come with that body clock.
Yeah.
And there are certainly people who leave the world faster than projected, and those who stay much longer than than the doctor thinks.
Absolutely.
Who makes the determination?
And that's a huge unknown. No one, like you said, nobody has a clock where we all know exactly at what moment we're all going
to
expire.
And if they stay 6 months, once the 6 months is up, does hospice say, I'm sorry, we're packing up, we'll come back at another time?
No. So I'll start with your first question. The determination of 6 months or less, if the terminal illness makes its normal course.
So let's pick a disease. When we start, I need more
specifics.
And things I can think about in my head. So okay. let's say leukemia. I don't know why I'm picking that. But
let's say that.
So leukemia.
So leukemia runs its course, right? This patient who has leukemia is receiving care from their primary physician. They're going downhill. They're declining. The disease is running its course. Physicians, whoever that physician might be, that patient's primary care physician, is going to make a determination. If the family is open to hospice care, then it's really on that physician to make that recommendation and make that prognosis that if this course runs as it normally would, 6 months or less is likely how long you have to live. And again, there's no magic solution. There's no magic formula. So this is really up to each individual physician's expertise and knowledge of that individual patient. And it's really on a case-by-case basis. And that doesn't have to do as much with Hospice of the Piedmont. The way that it does have to do with Hospice of the Piedmont is you have to have that recommendation from a physician, if you have a primary care physician, related to your primary terminal diagnosis. If you don't have a primary care physician, we have a senior medical director and a team of medical experts who will assess each patient on a case-by-case basis and assess whether, yes, we think if this disease runs its normal course, 6 months or less will be how long this person will live. However, if 6 months passes and the patient is still in our care, still doing well, then we readmit them. It's just a continuing, ongoing evaluation of the patients done by our senior medical director and done by our medical team to continue to be able to provide them the care. There is no 6 month to the day window and then you're out. You know, we have patients who have received care for years. We have a lot more patients who have received care for days because a lot of people come to us very late in the progression of their disease.
What about, you mentioned in the disease again, Rachel Palm here from Hospice of the Piedmont, as we talk about all the issues related to hospice care. You mentioned that this hospice care begins once the patient has given up on the curative process.
Mm-hmm.
So let's continue with the disease of leukemia.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor says to the patient, you know, you're giving up kind of early. There are a lot of curative steps that you could still take that have a healthy percentage of, you know, signs of success.
Mm-hmm.
I can't force you to follow those. I can't force you to take those. But if you choose not to, then yes, 6 months or less is likely.
Yeah.
What happens then? What does Hospice of the Piedmont say? What do you have any back history with of an issue like that where health insurance might step in and do something?
So health insurance really is only requiring that prognosis by the doctor of 6 months or less. If a patient chooses not to pursue curative treatment, let's think about what curative treatment really is. It sounds great in theory when you're saying curative treatment because it could potentially be a cure. But if you're a patient who's been through months or years of other curative treatment and your body is tired and run down and ravaged from chemotherapy or radiation or any of these other treatments, there might come a point where you say, okay, my quality of life is more important than quantity. And if curative treatment, whatever that treatment might be, is going to buy me 2 months, but I'm going to feel awful during that 2 month period, and I'm not going to be able to get out of bed, and I'm not going to be able to hang out with my kids or my grandkids, what kind of life is that? You know, so really that's when the patient and the family need to have a conversation about quality of life versus quantity of life.
Yeah. I mean, it's not the same thing. I won't admit it to being the same thing, but I had a similar instance with a dog that I was very close to who had liver cancer, and we took the medicines and we did all the different types of treatments, and after where he went months past the expected dates, but he was obviously uncomfortable, and so it was, you know, the burden falls on you as for euthanasia or what do you do, and it was, we're not going to do these medicines anymore, and then we're going to make decisions from that. And his, his appetite picks up and his quality of life changes, you know, improves. And then when it dropped off again, it was easier to make that final decision.
I think that's a great comparison. I think maybe people listening have dealt with having to lose a pet and maybe not losing someone close to them. In my family, specifically, I have instances of that with my own dog, and my sister actually just had to put her dog down. It's the same thing. It's awful. I mean, they are such a huge part of your family, and I think the same questions apply. Is this being, this sentient being, having quality of life, and how do you weigh the treatment that you provide to make sure that they are having quality of life, that they still enjoy getting up and running around and eating steak and eggs and playing with the kids? Or are they miserable and suffering and you're providing treatment to prolong their life for your own benefit?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the decision was, let's stop the curative treatment and let's do the other thing.
Yeah.
Home time hospice care for Lazarus. So what time is it? 11:20 here on the Wake Up Call. We'll be back with a conversation with Rachel Palm from Hospice of the Piedmont, talking about terminal illness and hospice care and a little bit more. Hang tight. Beautiful day in the neighborhood. Please enjoy it. And please support our underwriters. You've heard the commercial messages here we run on 94.7. They might sound like commercials, but they follow certain rules to limit the hype and the income from them. All goes to keeping the progressive voice on the air. It doesn't go to out-of-state corporation to boost the salaries of their executives, because even without contributing to the station, which we hope you will, you can help right now by supporting the businesses you hear on WPVC. Businesses like the Marcus of Tiger Fuel or Rapture on the downtown mall, and telling them how much you appreciate them supporting 94.7 WPVC. And by supporting us here at Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, as we talk about important and difficult conversations and topics like hospice care. Rachel Palm here to help us with the conversation. Rachel, we're talking about caring for the patient.
Mm-hmm.
And we got into that at the last moment, talking about caring for the pet. I want to know how the person who chooses, how do you come up with the caretakers for the patient at the hospital? Do you just select who's next on the list and who's available? Is there some sort of matchmaking plan that goes into things?
That's a good question. So our teams of our interdisciplinary teams are divided geographically. So that's really what dictates how our care is provided. So we have nurses, social workers, chaplains, CNAs, and volunteers that are each dedicated to a specific region within our 12-county service area. And then the load of patients, so to speak, for each individual on that team, I think is just based on years of experience and other patients. You know, it's always changing, and me not being on the clinical side on that team in particular, I'm not sure exactly how that works, but I do know that geography has a lot to do with it.
If anybody from hospice is listening, they're welcome to call. Anybody's
yeah.
welcome to call up 284-9470. That's 434-284-9470, whether you're with Hospice of the Piedmont with a tidbit of information that Rachel, you can expand on Rachel's knowledge on that topic, or you have a question you want to add, or a conversation, you have a story you want to throw in there to our talk today with Rachel Palm. I asked the question because I was wondering whether you and I were talking about the dog issue, and again, I don't want to make them the same thing, because I know that they're not, but I do believe that they are stepping stones to decision-making similarities. And it made me wonder if the caretakers who had a background in a specific illness, who might understand how things worked for some patients going through a type of illness a little better than someone else who had not experienced that.
Yeah.
And so if CNA number one, who had worked with people with kidney failure, was available, let's put that person with this patient.
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but what I know is that people with end-stage illness and people who are approaching death, there are certain things that are universal. There are certain qualities and processes that apply to everyone. So no matter what the disease is, the care that we provide is going to be the best, and we're going to probably see approximately the same sorts of things going on with our patients when they're actively dying. You know, there are certain steps that everyone goes through when they're knocking on heaven's door, so to speak, regardless of what the disease is that led them to that point.
11:25 here with Rachel Palm, Hospice of the Piedmont. Did any of the stories percolate in the back of your brain? Do you have a story to share with us?
Yeah, I do. So I said that I started working at Hospice of the Piedmont 3 years ago. And about a year after I started working for Hospice of the Piedmont, I was really privileged to meet this wonderful woman. She lived out in Crozet. I met her through one of our fundraising events where we featured artists, and it was a auction. It was an art sale. We sold art to benefit Hospice of the Piedmont, and we had one patient who was starting to be a prolific artist in the latter stages of her life. She had a number of cancers. I mean, she had a really rough go of it. She had had multiple cancer diagnoses over the course of her life, from when she had her children to when she ended up passing away and her children were in their 20s. So she came under hospice care at a point when obviously she was no longer interested in pursuing curative treatment. She'd done chemo, she'd done radiation, she'd done everything. And she just said, you know, I want to be at home. I want to have quality of life. I want to spend time with my husband and my kids and my dog. And so she went home to this beautiful house in Crozet, and I went over and visited her to hear her story one day. I ended up visiting her several times afterwards. She was such an inspiring woman. She was so positive, and she just had this energy about her, knowing that she was doing exactly what she wanted, where she wanted to do it. Her living room where I visited her was covered with art that she had created. She had a studio downstairs set up where she painted every day. She was having art shows for the first time in her life at various establishments around Charlottesville. And she was really making the most of every single day. And during that time when I saw her, she was in a moderate amount of pain, I imagine, as anyone with terminal illness and cancer growing in their body is. But she was just luminescent. I mean, she was just a wonderful person to be around. She had life oozing out of her. She ended up living for a year and a half after I visited her. And she had already been on hospice care for several months when I visited her. So she was one of those special cases where that 6-month diagnosis is not accurate. And she was a fighter. And I think there were still things that she wanted to do. But I was really, really proud to meet her and proud that Hospice of the Piedmont was able to provide her with the tools that she needed to fulfill some of those final wishes and become a showing artist, if nothing else. It was really, really awesome.
Do you have a piece of her art in your house?
I don't. Gosh, I should. I have numerous photos of her, and she lives in my mind.
That's Rachel Palm, Hospice of the Piedmont, www.hopva.org. That's Hospice of the Piedmont, Virginia.org. We are talking today about hospice care, terminal illness, grief, and death. All part of the conversation. You can call us 284-9470. If you want to be part of the conversation, ask a question. Go to the website, find out more about hospice care with definitions, see some of the programs. We're going to get into that in the next half hour of the program. It is 29 after the hour. I want to know about the spiritual support. You've mentioned several times how part of the program, the non-reimbursement part includes spiritual.
So actually our core hospice service, the reimbursable part includes that spiritual component. So our core hospice service includes an interdisciplinary team, which is a social worker, chaplain, nurse, certified nursing aide, and
so there's a chaplain involved.
Yes.
Do you find that the majority of people are already faith-based, or are these folks who are reaching out to become sort of clear their past history and reach out to whatever spirit there is and find one?
It depends. You know, I think that there are a lot of people under our care who have lived a life of really devout spirituality. And for them, they might not even need the services of our chaplain. They might have their own pastor or spiritual leader that they rely on as they get Hospice of the Piedmont's care. So our chaplain is there as a service if it's needed, if it's wanted. There are people who might not want to talk about religion or might not want to talk about God or just want to talk about what happens next in a spiritual way and not a necessarily religious or secular way. And our chaplains are available for any of that. You know, I mean, they are trained as chaplains, but they're really there to provide spiritual counseling and support to that patient, wherever that patient is, whatever that patient needs.
I'm curious how faith-based hospice care is in general.
That's a good question. I mean, obviously, we can't hire or discriminate people based on their religious preference.
Right.
So it really is a case by case. You know, we want to meet that patient wherever they are. So if they're highly spiritual and they want to pray and they want Bible verses read and they want to sing hymns, by all means, we'll make that happen. And they'll be paired with a volunteer who can help make that happen, who is probably a more spiritual volunteer that can read from the Bible to them and provide that comfort to them. But if there's a patient who is not interested in that sort of thing, then they don't need to explain themselves or, you know, we try to meet patients where they are.
But what I'm talking about is there are some social issues in today's culture mm-hmm. that are very faith-based.
Yes.
When this program has talked with folks about the homeless. It seems as though the majority of organizations helping the homeless come from a faith-based background.
Yeah.
When we talk about medical issues, and we start with talking about curative care, mm-hmm. there doesn't seem to be much faith in the conversation. It doesn't mean that there's not faith in the individuals who are partaking, whether they're giving or receiving.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that just because you're a doctor doesn't mean you go to church.
True.
But I wonder if once you reach the hospice side, does the faith become a much larger part of the picture?
I think that's a great point. And I do think that spirituality and faith are a big piece of the puzzle for a lot of people. But it is just a part of that puzzle. And we're not a faith-based organization. We have a faith outreach component where we work with community churches and religious leaders. But that's not behind our mission. That's not behind our vision per se. It is part of the care that we provide. But really, the care that we provide is also taking care of a person's body, taking care of a person's emotion, and taking care of a person's social network.
Do you find that, again, our guest today, Rachel Palm from Hospice of the Piedmont, as we talk about hospice care, everything that goes into that, the terminal illness that brings someone and their family to hospice care, and the grief and the death that make this up. Do you know, you mentioned having this be your background, having sort of brought you to mm-hmm. Hospice of the Piedmont, and your experience, the stories that you have to share with us during the hour. I'm curious, is hospice care sort of have its own 12-step program? We know of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross.
Mm-hmm.
Where are my notes? Because I can never get them in the proper order without cheating. 5 stages of grief: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Do people in hospice care, do they rebuild their relationships? Do they end up calling the people, the family members and the friends that
Absolutely.
They felt like that have had, you know, been broken or tainted? And
absolutely. Absolutely. And that's one of the big things that we try to take care of on the social side when we're nurturing a patient. If that patient, for example, has an estranged relationship with his son. Our previous CEO had some wonderful stories. He had worked in hospice care for decades, and he had a couple of really great stories going into care for patients. And the patient had an estranged relationship with his father. One of the things that our social workers will do at the end of life when, you know, that's the time, you have to say those final words. You have to say, I love you. I'm sorry. I forgive you. Say those final goodbyes. Our social workers really try to help the patient and the family and their community work through those issues so that there can be peace. I mean, that's really the end goal. The end goal is peace and comfort and dignity before death. So if that means repairing estranged relationships and saying all the things that need to be said, then that's absolutely what is done.
And Hospice of the Piedmont, that's part of, you keep talking or have mentioned several times, the interdisciplinary part.
Yeah.
So that's the role or one of the roles of the social worker.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, that's pretty much the main role of the social worker, is to come in and assess, what is this patient's social situation like? What are their support networks? Are their family members around? Do they have friends around? You know, just what does their social situation look like? And if there are things that need to be repaired, how can that social worker help to make those repairs and get those things done that need to be done in the last days and months and weeks of life?
Do you have a story that comes to mind?
I have a lot of stories. I wish that my former CEO, as I mentioned, Dr. Jim Avery, he told some really great stories. The one that I just mentioned about going into a patient's home, and I believe it was the son that was terminally ill. And so Dr. Avery walked into this home, and the son was terminally ill. He was like 18. He was really young. And he goes in and he says, what's going on? How are you feeling? And the son says, you know, I feel awful. I can't stand my father. And Jim realizes, Dr. Avery realizes, oh, we've got some problems here. We need to figure out what's going on. Well, there have been allegations of abuse, allegations of the father not being present, not giving the love that the son thought he needed. So that was the focus. That was where, you know, when the patient is the focus, the family is also the focus. So immediately they kind of got to work on how can this father and son come to terms and reconcile and say the things that they need to say before the son passes away. Because can you imagine the grief that that father would live with? The father and son weren't speaking at this point, even though the son was at home in his father's house in bed dying. They had no relationship. So that was a real crisis situation. It was critical that those relationships were mended. The social worker involved in that case really got to work with talking to both and resolving the issues. And, you know, at some point you just have to kind of forgive and forget and get on with it because days are numbered.
Yeah, I would think that that would be incredibly difficult. I mean, it's a difficult task.
Yes.
It sounds like a very difficult task. There are, if you're a therapist, this may take years.
Absolutely.
And if you're a clinical worker in a hospice, you may have days.
Days. But you know what? At the end of life, I think there's part of
your
everybody.
Your grudge is thinner?
Yeah. There's part of everybody that says, you know, who cares? I imagine, I mean, I've never been that close to death, but I saw my dad that close to death, and I saw him just let go of everything, all the anger that he had been holding on to and the grudges and the resentment and just really want to be at peace with everyone. Because when you're that close to death, you understand that when you leave, there's no coming back. There's no making amends on things that you don't make amends for before you pass away.
11:39 here on the Wake Up Call. I hope you've been listening to this program because we have rocked it for 39 minutes. And if you haven't, check out the podcast, which will be up a little bit later today on SeavillePodcast.com. Rachel Palm here from Hospice of the Piedmont, HOPVA.org, talking about hospice care, terminal illness, grief, and a little bit about death, because that's where it all leads to. Hang tight. And thank you for being with us today. It's a nice Sunday because it's not yet 95 degrees, humid and sweaty, but predictions. So again, hospice care. You know, Rachel Palm from Hospice of the Piedmont, the topic always comes up. I'm sure it comes up every day, if not with almost every patient with you, about euthanasia. One of the things that is one of the standards for hospice care is quality of life, right to make your own decisions, dignity. But in the state of Virginia, we don't allow euthanasia, right? Mm-hmm. It's considered suicide, which is illegal, correct?
Mm-hmm.
How do you have this conversation? Hospice of the Piedmont, as an organization, says what on the topic?
Well, we certainly don't endorse euthanasia or assisted suicide by any means. It's illegal. It's not the type of care that we want to provide. We want to provide comfort care. We want to provide care that encourages quality of life. So whatever that means, you know, if a patient is really, really, really sick and even actively dying, then we're going to do whatever we need to do. We're going to be there as much as we need to be there to make sure that patient is comfortable, that they're not short of breath, that they're not in pain, that they're not struggling in any way. So hopefully that will achieve the goal of the patient and the patient's family, which is to pass with dignity and peace.
But the family still and the patient, I'm certain, still have these conversations with the caregivers or with others, yourself or others at hospice. I would think you can't make that statement and expect the conversation to end.
Right. Oh, it's always an ongoing conversation.
Right.
I mean, that's the nature of the care that we provide, is that we're always reassessing. We're always tweaking, reevaluating to make sure the patient is surviving or, you know, thriving at optimal levels that they can. No one has ever had the conversation with me in particular, just based on my role at the organization. I can't imagine that they would, but certainly with it being in the news in the last year and a half, the well-publicized case of the woman out on the West Coast who moved to Oregon. Was it Oregon? I think it was Oregon or Washington State in order to have assisted suicide. She had the same cancer diagnosis that my dad had, and it is it's a really brutal cancer that I watched my dad suffer through and die from. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that we don't have other options in this state. And I don't know what those conversations sound like inside of a patient's home between the patient and the family and our team members.
Are you aware of any, whether it's Hospice of the Piedmont included or others, other businesses and organizations where Hospice of the Piedmont is outside looking on, but other groups where people are going towards the General Assembly saying, look, assisted suicide needs to be given consideration as an acceptable form of treatment. Mm-hmm. For instances like this.
I do know of that personally, that those groups exist and that they are going to the General Assembly to ask for legislation changes and reforms. But Hospice of the Piedmont does not have anything to do with that.
Not participating,
not looking on, not affiliated in any way.
All right. Rachel, so let's talk about some of the programs.
Yeah.
That you, I'm sure you have major things to do with.
Sort of.
I want to talk about the kids.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to talk about kids who are patients for hospice care. Okay. I want to talk about the kids in the family who are having to process and deal with this.
Yes.
And what Hospice of the Piedmont does in terms of offering help.
Yeah. So that's one of the really cool things that we do that's part of our non-reimbursable programs. We provide grief support to the patient's family for up to a year after the patient has passed away. So that obviously includes the kids, and a lot of what we do through our Center for Children and our Journeys program is provide outlets for these kids in the form of camps. We have two camps that take place, one in the spring and one in the fall. They're full day camps here in Charlottesville or the Albemarle region. And we invite kids who have lost a loved one to come and participate in really fun activities that help with the grieving process, help with expression. So we have a lot of artistic expression, musical expression, and then some just fun stuff like riding horses and, you know, other fun camp stuff. But the camp's goal really is to bring together kids who have experienced a loss so that they can understand they're not alone and so that they can process that grief in a safe and supported place. And we have tons of volunteers. We have certified art therapists and a number of other people who come and assist those kids in having a kind of structured environment in which they can process grief and start to heal.
You can find out about a lot of these programs, by the way, on the website, hopva.org, if we don't go into the details that you'd like to learn more about, or you can call in with a question, 284-9470. Again, Rachel Palm here from Hospice of the Piedmont, as we talk about hospice care and terminal illness. What else? There's got to be more there than just bringing these kids in for a week at two times a year.
Yeah. I was trying to look up the date of the next camp, and I'm afraid I can't find it. It's in early October. But in addition to the camps, we also provide individual counseling, so one-on-one counseling if that's appropriate. We have support groups. We have these wonderful art therapists who go to children's homes or wherever is appropriate, schools, and work with the kids in this artistic way that has been proven to really help kids express their emotions that they might not otherwise be able to express. So creating something that helps them say the things they can't say with words, they can say it with art. We have another really cool group called Oasis that meets with teens who have lost someone close to them. So the programs that I just mentioned sometimes are geared a little bit more towards younger children. The age range for our Journeys group is age 5 through 18. The Oasis program specifically is for teenagers. So, you know, that's a pretty special age when might be hard to bond with other people over whatever. But we bring teens together and do creative activities, have dinner, have an opportunity for these teens to get to know each other and talk openly about their grief and, again, participate in creative expression that helps them heal and process their loss.
You know, we were talking about this, and I think the imagery, the sort of stereotype, is of the grandmother, the grandfather, the white-haired senior at home in the hospital bed, you know, that's been moved into their bedroom to help them for the last week of their life.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the many misconceptions about hospice.
And you said something in that last bit about the kid that made me think, you know what? These are kids coming home from school who have to go in to see their mom or their dad in their parents' bedroom because the parent is suffering from some form of cancer. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the daily life for this, you know, several months or, you know, whatever the time frame is. And the word I want to use is damage, and that's not the proper word to use here. But the difficulty that goes with that is I don't even know how to phrase that, because I just want to spit out this jumble of difficult words that follow along. But it makes me, you know, so thankful that hospice is there and thinks about how these kids are going to need help later on.
Yeah.
It's not just about showing up at the funeral and giving this kid a hug.
Yeah, absolutely. That's another thing that really differentiates hospice of the Piedmont. This is another of the programs that we provide that a for-profit entity would not provide. So we're not only providing care, as you mentioned, when the patient is in our care, when they're terminally ill, when they're at home and they're dying, but for up to a year afterwards, we're supporting the kids on a regular basis and supporting the rest of the patient's family. You know, you mentioned a mother or a father, so we need to support that partner after that person passes away. And the fact of the matter is, death is the great equalizer, and it doesn't discriminate. So we have patients of all ages. We have patients that are 100 years old. We have patients that are, you know, 25 years old.
You know, I said I didn't want to talk about this part, but you do have, or do you have, kids as patients?
Yeah, so we have a program called Piedmont Kids, and it's a little bit different from our core hospice program or from the programs I was just talking about. So we work with Continuum Healthcare to provide non-medical treatment. So we provide the interdisciplinary care minus that medical treatment. We provide the social support, the emotional support, and the spiritual support to kids who are terminally ill. And we work with this other healthcare organization. They provide the medical care. So it's kind of a two-pronged approach to helping kids who are terminally ill. And it's just an awful, awful thing to think about. A child being terminally ill and what the parents and the family go through. But we're really proud to offer this service. It's a service that did not exist in this community before Hospice of the Piedmont established Piedmont Kids. So it's another one of those services that we provide because the community said, hey, we need this, and who else is going to provide it?
53 minutes after the hour here today with Rachel Palm from Hospice of the Piedmont. A difficult but necessary and engaging conversation. I hope everybody out there is enjoying it. 94.7 WPVC. This is the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Next week, by the way, Dr. Pam Moran, superintendent of Albemarle County Schools, will be here. Good luck to her trying to beat this conversation. Rachel, what happens, part of the conversation for hospice care is that it engages the patient to be part of the decision making,
mm-hmm.
right? What happens when, but you still have the family. I mean, there's still, it's, let's take the patient home and put them in a comfortable place and allow them to be part, you know, they've now made the decision that it's no longer, I don't want the chemotherapy anymore. I don't want the radiation. I want to feel better while I finish my time.
Yep.
But as I'm sure we all know, families don't always agree on things.
This is true.
So how does hospice care work with that?
Well, that, again, I think is part of the conversation that the social worker is going to have, you know, navigating those tricky relationships or disagreements. I would hope when it comes to the decision to pursue treatment, whether it's hospice care or continued medical curative treatment, that the family is on the same page. But I know that's not always the case. So that's really tricky, you know, and usually the patient is, if the patient's able to make the decisions, then I would think that they would be the ones making the final decision, you know, for their own health care. That's my assumption, not being on the clinical side and seeing those situations. But it's tricky. I mean, death is so simple in theory, but everything leading up to it and everything that follows it is so complicated and so rife with turmoil and disagreements and grief and everything that's what our amazing social workers navigate every day.
When the patient is home, and I realize that every patient is different. Yes. Every patient has their own wants, mm-hmm. and needs, their own form of care.
Mm-hmm.
But what if the patient has high blood pressure? I realize that's probably not why they're there for hospice care.
Exactly.
And loves politics and the two political conventions are on.
Yeah.
You know, that's the sort of thing is, do you let them enjoy what they want?
That's right.
Do you let them enjoy what they want?
I would say, yeah, we're going to let them watch the conventions and we're just going to continue to give them their blood pressure medication, obviously.
You bring in the ice cream?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I mean, here's another funny story. There's a patient that I know about who... he'd been in the hospital and he'd been receiving curative treatment and, you know, the doctors are, you know, you've got to lose weight and you can't eat fried chicken every day and you can't eat as badly as you do and your blood pressure is horrible and you've got to stop smoking. You know, they're really trying to get this man healthy. He's a father. And, he finally gets to the point where he decides he wants to be on hospice care and he wants to go home and not receive curative treatment anymore. First thing he does when he gets home is lights a cigarette, get some fried chicken and Oreos, and he is just in heaven. Not literally, but he is just really enjoying those vices because that's what makes him happy. And who are we to say you can't have your fried chicken and your Oreos when you have months or weeks or days to live?
You know, I've been mentioning the sort of the imagery that goes with hospice care of being at home in your bed. But one of the things I found when visiting the website, hopva.org, Hospice of the Piedmont, is it's not always at home.
Correct. Yeah, so we provide care to a patient wherever they are. Sometimes that's in a private residence. We also go to nursing homes, assisted living facilities, continuous care retirement communities. We also have these two really great residential facilities where we provide care for patients whose needs are too great to be met at home. So if a patient is at home and either their caretaker can't take care of them, if they need really aggressive comfort care, really advanced symptom management, or if they just don't have the caretaker to do that, they can go to the hospice house, which is located over on Park Street, just right around the corner from downtown, 501 Park Street. It is an 8-bed unit where it's in an old Victorian home, and it's just like a home. It's a beautiful, light-filled facility where patients go and spend their last months and weeks and days, and we have the same care provided there. We have our social workers, our nurses, our CNAs, volunteers and chaplains fully staffed all the time. So a great place for patients whose needs can't be met at home. Then we also have the Center for Acute Hospice Care, which just opened in January, and that's over in the Northridge Medical Park. It's on the third floor of UVA Transitional Care Hospital. And that's just kind of another level above the hospice house in terms of the care that we provide. So it's for really people who need really aggressive symptom management, who are really in need of acute care. So a lot of times coming from the hospital straight over there, if they're no longer pursuing curative treatment. It's a 10-bed unit. Again, it's beautiful and light-filled, and we just have wonderful, compassionate, lovely staff members who are filling these places and taking care of our patients every day.
Last question for you. We just have a few seconds left. Do you think that acceptance of death has changed in the last few decades, or is the fear of death about the same?
Well, I think that the conversation is becoming more forefront, and I think that's really important. That's one of the things that we're trying to accomplish with Hospice of the Piedmont, is having people face that conversation ahead of time and think about, what do you want for your death? Do you have an advance directive? When it's not a crisis situation, when people are in good health and you can have these conversations with your parents or with your loved ones, that's an important time to have those conversations. And I do think that that conversation is happening more than it did 10 or 20 years ago. So that's a good thing.
Rachel Palm from Hospice of the Piedmont. You can find the website HOPVA.org. Rachel, thank you so much for being with us.
I'm so glad you're having me. Thank you.
Thank you. Next week, Dr. Pam Moran from Albemarle County School System. Thank you, folks.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.